Up next, another story set against the backdrop of the Pacific War. Things fall to pieces in wartime. Families and communities get wrenched apart. Things get lost. And a lot of stories that come out of war are stories about loss. But every now and then, something that was lost turns out to have taken its own strange journey in the long aftermath of war. And that's the story that we're about to hear. The story of a lost object that ultimately brought two men from opposite sides of the conflict unexpectedly together. Those two men are the late medical specialist Philip Jobson, who was an army surgeon with the Australian forces in the Pacific, and Yoshihide Masayama, a Zen Buddhist priest who served in the Japanese military forces. Well, in 2003, 2 years before he died, Phil Jobson told his story to Michelle Rayner. And you'll also hear Phil's daughter, Stephanie Clare, his grandson, Tom Dowling, and readings from the letters of Yoshihide Masayama.
Japanese naval and air forces launched an unprovoked attack on...
Well, my name is Jobson, J-O-B-S-O-N. Christian name, Philip.
My name's Stephanie Clare, and I'm Phil Jobson's daughter.
Phil's story.
I think it was the end of 1943. I was in a field ambulance. I was posted to a field ambulance, which is a collecting and evacuating unit. The next thing I heard was that we were going to New Guinea. And in due course, I was posted to command of the 8th Field Ambulance.
His job was to establish an army hospital to be ready to absorb casualties from fighting. And fighting was going on nearby, and they did many, many operations patching up wounded soldiers.
Yoshi's story.
Good day. My name is Yoshihide Masayama. I am Japanese and I am a Zen Buddhist priest. My father was a priest and his father was a priest also. My family and I live in a city which is 2 hours from Tokyo by train. My wife and I have 2 daughters and 3 grandsons, and we all live together in a house attached to the temple. Life is very pleasant for me now. But it was not always like this. I have lived through war, starvation, imprisonment, illness, and the shock of returning to Japan at the end of World War II. I was born in 1913, and so I was a young man during the 1930s. In Japan, the 1930s saw the rise of nationalism and a great increase in the power of the army. Now, this time is called the Dark Valley. At the age of 19, I entered the military academy where I trained for 2 years. My parents arranged for me to be married, and soon after this, I was sent to fight the war in Manchuria. I will always remember how my wife, my mother, and my father looked at me as I stood in our living room, ready to depart. They were very proud of me in my smart army uniform. Then my father stepped forward. He was holding our family ceremonial sword in both hands. He presented me with the sword, saying, "My son, the sword has been in our family for over 200 years. Take good care of it." The sword was about 1 meter long, with a slightly curved blade. What made my sword really special was its handle, which was made of shark skin. About 6 months after I left for the war, my father died. I was very sad, but at least I carried our family sword with me all the time. With the sword, I was never alone. I felt my father and all my ancestors were with me.
Later on, they did make a push up into North Bougainville and had contact with the Japanese forces there. There was quite a lot of them. There was quite a big Japanese force there too. A certain amount of fighting had to go on, of course.
Yoshi's story, 1941.
When Japan entered World War II in 1941, I became a field artillery officer. I was proud to serve my country in Hong Kong, Sumatra, and New Guinea. As the war went on, our generals kept on telling us things were going well for Japan. But there were many signs that this was not the truth. For example, at first our heavy guns were pulled by horses. Later, the generals came to us and took the horses for their own use. We were told to take our guns apart and haul them through the jungle ourselves, and this is what we did. Towards the end of the war, Japan captured the Pacific island of Nauru. Many of the Australians and Nauruans who worked in the phosphate industry on the island became prisoners of war. I was one of the officers sent to Nauru to guard these prisoners of war. When I was on Nauru, the news suddenly came that Japan had surrendered and World War II was over. We did not know that the US had dropped atomic bombs on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan.
Can you remember then when victory was announced and the declaration of the end of the war?
Yes. When we got the message about that, there were a lot of American ships anchored round about the place. And of course they did the usual thing of firing up everything they had in every direction. I was dead scared we were going to get American shells in the cookhouse any minute.
The Australian army came in. Very quickly, they set up a prisoner of war camp and put all the Japanese officers and soldiers in it. At first, we thought we would all be shot. But the days passed and this did not happen. The Australians put us to work building bridges and roads. They treated us very well and we did not have to work too hard. The Australians ordered us to hand over all our weapons, including our swords. This was a very, very bad time for us. Our general made us clean our weapons until they shone. I felt very sad as I polished my sword. I thought, this sword has been in my family for many generations. Now it is going from us. And I am the one who is losing it. Just before I gave up my sword, I had a sudden idea. Quickly, I tore a strip of cotton from my shirt and wrote my name on it. Then I tied the cotton strip to the handle of the sword. I don't know why I did this, but I know it made me feel a little better.
Our surrender ceremony was held on the frigate Diamantina, which was anchored just off the coast of Nauru. The Japanese were brought on board. They all came on. They all lined up on parade, came to attention, saluted, and stood with their swords, you see, and their weapons. And then they were told that they were to pile all the swords and any weapons with them in one place. Just all together in one place. Well, then, the terms of surrender were read out, first of all in English, and then in Japanese by the interpreter. And then they were asked if they understood, and they said yes.
Tell me then how the sword came into your possession.
Every officer was given a sword and a binocular, quite indiscriminately, you know, just sort of picked one off the heap. So I left them down in my cabin, and of course the binoculars very fairly promptly disappeared. But anyway, I came home with the sword. It was a long two-handed sword. The handle obviously is a work of art. It's beautifully made. It was shark skin. Then there was a piece of rag tied on the thing.
I tore a strip of cotton from my shirt
with some Japanese writing.
and wrote my name on it, Yoshihide Masayama.
And I got one of the interpreters to have a look, and I said, look, what's this? And he said, oh, crap. He said, I don't know. It was pretty dirty by then. And when I brought it home, of course, I showed it to everybody, and they were interested and so forth. And I wasn't very keen on the thing being handed round. It was this whacking great sharp thing about this long.
My father would periodically get the sword up from where it was stored underneath our house, and he would take it out of its scabbard, and he had some oil, and he would polish it or sort of oil the sword to keep it in a good state. Now, I and my sisters also, we always wanted to touch the sword, and my father always said, don't touch the blade, it's sharp.
What did your father tell you about how he came by it?
He didn't tell us very much. In fact, we had the feeling that maybe he had picked it up on a beach or something like that. I think that people tended to downplay after the war. People didn't want to talk about it. We weren't aware of the ceremonial nature of the handover and the official nature of the handover.
Early in 1947, we received some news. We were told that a ship from Japan was coming to take us home. The Japan I returned to was shockingly different from the Japan I had left. And I was different too. When I reached my city, I got a terrible shock. It was almost completely destroyed. My mother was alive, but my wife was among the many thousands of people killed in the bombing raids. Over the coming years, we rebuilt our city and we rebuilt our lives. I took up my duties as a priest in the temple, just as my father and his father had done. Sometime later, in 1959, I decided to marry again, and my wife and I had two daughters. Yet in my heart, I always carried a feeling of sadness about the loss of my sword.
Phil's story, 1977.
Anyway, I stacked it away, and it was in a rubber, leather scabbard. So I stacked it away under the house. I got it out one day, and I looked out, and I thought, what am I going to do with this thing? I don't want it in the house, because I didn't know what kids or visiting children might come in and find it and start acting the goat with it and so forth. And I thought, well, there's only one thing to do with this. It's a work of art. It antedates the war and any history of hostilities amongst us. It's got to go back to its owner, its original owner. So I took it down to an organisation that called themselves the Friends of Japan. Well, they were fascinated. And they said, look, we think it should go to the consul. And they found the owner.
11th of January, 1978.
Department of Defence. Reference Captain Masayama, Imperial Japanese Army, Nauru, 1945. Dear sir, I was a member of the Australian Army detachment which went to Nauru Island in 1945 to take over from Japanese force in occupation there. Whilst there, I was given a surrendered Japanese sword.
As soon as I found out who he was and where he was, I rang up our intelligence people in Sydney and said, look, is there anything bad known about this man? I discovered after war, I found that he'd done the same thing about me to the Japanese army.
Before engaging in what could become a continuing and friendly correspondence, I would like to be assured that nothing is known against him, as I know that the Europeans who remained on Nauru, as well as some Nauruans, were killed by the Japanese after an American raid. I would be most grateful. Yours faithfully, Lieutenant Colonel Dr. P.L. Jobson.
Department of Defence, 21st February, 1978. Dear Dr. Jobson, the records of the Australian War Memorial have been checked and no evidence has been found associating Captain Shoyama or Yoshihide Masayama with war crimes on Nauru. I'm attaching a copy of the Australian War Memorial letter giving the result.
Yoshi's story.
One day in 1977, I received a telephone call from an official at the town hall. He asked me if I wanted my sword back. At first, I did not understand what he was talking about. After all, I had lost my sword more than 30 years ago and had never heard a thing about it since. The official had to tell me again. Your sword has come back from Australia. It had your name written on it, and we have found you. Come to the town hall and collect it. When I told my family this news, they were very excited. We could not believe what had happened. We went straight to the town hall together. The official handed me a package. Feeling very strange, I unwrapped it. It really was my sword. With its distinctive sharkskin handle and the strip of cotton tied to it, I would know it anywhere. As I held it for the first time after 32 years, I felt something like an electric shock pass through my body. When we went home, we made a special ceremony of thanks at the temple, and we put the sword back in the place where it had always been. From that time onwards, I felt peace in my heart and a great feeling of gratitude towards the Australian soldier who had sent my sword back to me. Of course, it was important to me to write a letter to thank him. The official at the town hall said he would arrange for the letter to be translated into English and sent to Australia. When I finished writing the letter, I had a sense that my life was complete.
They sent the sword back to the old owner, you see, and from him I got, he sent me a scroll, a wall scroll. Oh, it was a magnificent thing. A picture of Mount Fujiyama and a long letter. The letter's about 9 feet long and about 18 inches wide.
Dear Sir, now in Japan, autumn has passed and it is the winter season which might bring us a lot of snow. It is nearly the end of 1977 and we are having a very busy time. I'm Yoshihide Masayama. Some time ago, you sent me my sword. Now I'm writing a letter to you with full thanks. There were many military officers who offered their swords to your country, but only I have been gifted by your good act. Even though I never knew you, you kept on holding my sword for many years. So I really can feel your warm mind through this sword. I want to say to you again, thank you very much for your kindness.
I was the only person who'd sent a sword back.
What did you learn about Mr. Masayama?
Armies are very much the same.
So my father was absolutely delighted when one day a letter arrived from Mr. Masayama. A translation had come also with it, so we were able to read it in English. And it was very much our own family's project, our own personal war reconciliation project. And so that's why we're pleased to have contributed to the thing ourselves.
The interesting thing is that Stephanie's son, Tom...
Your grandson.
My grandson is fluent in Japanese. And now he's working with the Australian Embassy in Tokyo. And he has a Japanese wife.
As a child, I don't remember the sword. The first time I really remember seeing the sword was at Mr. Masayama's temple. But when I was young, all I remembered about the sword was that it had been given back. We'd missed the sword, as it were. Then it caught up with me in Japan.
Tom had been living in Japan for probably about 8 or so years, and suddenly I had the brainwave, except it was a really slow brainwave. Why don't we contact Mr. Masayama?
Once Mum had this idea of contacting the sword, finishing, making a story of it, was, you know, like a dog on your ankle. You just, we had to get this thing finished or done. And I just started at the embassy when Mum was visiting. Part of my job is ringing people up out of the blue. So along those lines, I said, my name's Tom Dowling. I know this is strange. I live in Tokyo. I speak Japanese. And you know, I'm the grandson of the man who gave your sword back. And there was stunned silence. And we said, well, we'd like to visit you. And they said, well, come down next week. So we hopped on a bullet train and got off at their station, Shizuoka, and hopped into a taxi and said, we want to go to this temple.
Yes. And it was a temple.
That's right, it was. When we got to the temple, outside the temple was standing an old man, very upright, wearing white robes. And we said to each other, that must be Mr. Masayama. And so he greeted us and we hopped out of the taxi. And thereupon happened this extraordinary scene where Tom and Mr. Masayama started bowing at each other. It was extremely moving and we all had tears in our eyes. We were just so thrilled about it.
Every morning I have been praying that all the spirits of the dead can sleep well in paradise. I believe these prayers made me regain my sword, and I do hope not to have wars between any countries in the world. I'm sorry to send this letter so late. I wish you health and happiness.
On RN, you've been listening to The Story of the Sword, featuring the late Phil Jobson, his daughter Stephanie Clare, and his grandson Tom Dowling. Yoshihide Masayama's letters were read by Shing Go, and this has been an edited version of a program produced by Michelle Rayner and first broadcast on RN in 2003.